There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Welcome to Pop Culture, the podcast that brings soft drinks to the top of the menu. I'm Helen O'Hara, film journalist, author, and lifelong teetotaler.
And I'm Kat Brown, journalist and newly published author, Helen.
Woo!
I'd like to thank me, other people. Oh, and I'd like to thank you, Helen, because you came in pink and orange to match my special suit.
I mean, you told us what colours you were going to be in, Kat, so it was always going to happen. But yes, just to catch people up, Kat's book, It's Not a Bloody Trend, was published yesterday as we record this on February 1st, and we had a fantastic book launch party last night. I drank gingerella all night, which is always a good time, and it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And you had a fantastic suit, which was not just pink and orange, was it? It was also a metaphor.
It was a metaphor. It was beautiful, made of silk. One of my neighbours, not literally physically, but in the same place that I live, is the designer Shoni Wilkinson, who does loads of stuff for stage, for screen, and she also does fashion, sort of downs it a bit. But she asked if I'd be interested in collaborating on a project, by which I mean I wore the suit. That's the extent of my collaboration. But inspired by ADHD, so obviously that's the subject of the book, and she was really interested in how she could perhaps use details or frayed hems or different things to sort of bring that to life in a project that she's called ADH Design, which is
amazing.
Lovely. Yeah, wore it last night and just felt $1 million. Everybody that came up to sort of have a look at it and everything just adored it too. So it was just really, really wonderful. Sort of
looked $1 million also. Just
part
clear.
Of art, darling. Love it. Love that for me.
Yeah, it was great though. And what were you drinking? You had a fabulous mug and you were drinking
yes.
out of it.
My lovely friend Helen Whittaker, who is the author of several really excellent novels, gave me this gorgeous mug that she'd got from Etsy, which said published author. And it had the date of the book's release on it.
Oh.
And it was just so lovely. So I drank out of that all night. I was drinking Beavertown Laser Crush alcohol-free IPA, which is a really nice, light but oomphy beer that was just perfect for last night. And like you with gingerella, I could just sip away on that. And that was fab. The thing that we also had that was not drinks related or suit related, but was bloody amazing, was you and a bunch of our friends clubbed together and got Amy Richards, who's Amy's Bakes on Instagram. You can see some pictures of that on ours as well, to make a cake of the book, which was the most amazing thing that I've ever seen and eaten. I was very lucky that there was a little bit of it left over, with the result that I had some for breakfast this morning.
Quite
and did
right.
an interview with The Times with a very pink tongue.
That is as it should be.
Blue tongue, as it should not be. Exactly. I'm very tired. This is all very silly. No, it was a lovely party and lovely to launch it, and very grateful to Backstory and Ballum, partly for just having a really nice soft drink selection.
They really did, yeah. Wonderful, wonderful place. And lots of cheese also. You know, you don't have to have wine and cheese. You can have soft drinks and cheese. There's no law. They can't stop you.
For the last 2 or 3 weeks, I keep waking up at 1 o'clock in the morning for 2 or 3 hours. And for some reason, earlier this week, I was fixated on what on earth snacks you could serve in a bookshop without like ruining all the books. And then, like, the night before, I just ended up absolutely fixating on cheese. So I sort of went to the shops and came back armed with cheese straws, crisps, and then what I can only describe as a small mountain cave of very mature cheddar, which I chopped up into chunks. But thank God everybody bought into it and they ate the surprisingly large amount of cheese.
Mm. Yes, that was me, mostly.
Yes. Thank God for your service, Helen.
You know, I'm just here to help. Also, you had something, I know this is kind of peripheral to soft drinks, but also I feel like it's relevant. And that is you had very good crisps. They weren't just any crisps. They were very, very nice crisps. And one of the things that was nice about them, and if you're listening to this and you work in food development, please, please pay attention right now. One of the things that was great was they were the kind of crisps where lots of them are folded over. And it has long been my contention that folded over crisps taste better than two crisps piled on top of each other. I don't know why, but they do. The best crisps are folded over crisps, and I don't know why no one makes them that way. But the ones you had last night were heavy on the folded crisps, and I was just in hog heaven.
I actually went to a different shop specifically to buy the crisps. That is because it is my opinion, my humble opinion, that the Co-op does the greatest crisps. I was very restrained. I did not buy the salt and vinegar, which again are the best salt and vinegar crisps in creation, partly because they are also the most violent crisps in creation. But my husband tells me that not everybody loves having their mouth like brutally
assaulted
by salt and vinegar. Mm. So I just went for ready salted.
I mean, as ready salted goes, it was delicious.
Excellent.
So yes, we had a lovely time and your book is off to a fantastic start. It has already been reprinted. The demand is high. You were on proper Amazon charts, like in the hundreds, not the thousands. That's a big deal. So, you know. Big times.
I felt very excited when I was looking at the chart at 3 o'clock this morning, whilst, despite the fact this book is now launched, I apparently still cannot sleep. So really looking forward to seeing what insane obsession I get during my 2 hours of wakefulness tonight. Mm.
That used to be a really common thing, apparently, in the sort of 16th, 17th century. Apparently everyone just woke up in the middle of the night and they just leaned into it and just sat up and chatted.
That, honestly, that is something that I've really had to do. I slept really badly when I was younger anyway, probably for anxiety, and I just didn't get to sleep for hours and all the way through university. And one of my friends told me something a few years ago, which I've now just means that when I do have that wakefulness or I can't get back to sleep, I just don't stress about it so much, which is half of the horror of insomnia. And that is just, whether you're asleep or not, just resting is still good for you. Admittedly, I might be looking at the news on my phone whilst I'm doing it.
Not super restful.
It's not super restful, but honestly, by that point, I've done my, just close your eyes and try to get back to sleep. And then I'm like, I'm just bored. I'm just going to read until I get tired again. But yeah, just lying there and just knowing that recharging and resting is still happening is good. Still not as good as a really good night's sleep, but I hold great hopes that eventually I will become too tired not to sleep through the night.
Has that changed since giving up drink?
Yeah, massively.
Right.
This sounds ridiculous to say. I'm now no longer scared of bedtime.
Right.
When I was drinking, and to be honest, before I was drinking, I found, I think also just before I was treated, before I had a lot of therapy and understood what on earth was going on with my brain, I found the dark hours really upsetting, like really panic-inducing. Everything, I suppose it's that cliche, everything seems worse at night. And again, don't make any big decisions at night, you know, don't listen to what your brain is necessarily telling you at night. I think the only time that I sort of managed to come to some kind of understanding with nighttime hours was at university in my final year when I was just like, oh, 4 a.m, still not asleep, better write an essay. So at least that was a fairly efficient way of getting things done.
And at least in university, if it is 4 a.m, somebody's probably up anyway. I mean, it's not quite as alienating and as lonely as I think it can be.
Totally.
But I mean, childhood or adulthood.
Even during this weird period of book stress insomnia, the feeling is completely different to when I would wake up in the middle of the night because all of the sugar from the booze had just suddenly gone, hello, we're here. I'm not waking up and my head is turning circles or anything like that. There are just periods when people have crap sleep, but it would just be, I can't even imagine how horrendous it would have been if I can't even really imagine what the party would have been like if I'd been drinking. I probably would have insisted that we all went out to several bars afterwards. And given that this was in suburban South London.
Whereas the messages in our friend group afterwards were like, it was only a 15-minute walk home. This was fabulous. Which maybe says a lot about how old and boring we are. But I like to think it just means we're managing our time well.
I feel it's a very good life-work balance when you go to a party and then you're in your pyjamas 15 minutes after leaving the party. That was by 9:20 p.m, everybody. You really can have it all.
Well, it was not the only party I went to this week, actually.
Tell me more.
Not to show off, but I went to my six-year-old nephew's birthday party at a soft play.
The party weekend. Of the season!
It really was, for all of his friends, certainly. It was an interesting experience for me, just because I haven't really done that soft play party before. When I was younger, we did have birthdays in leisure centres, but certainly in Northern Ireland at that time, we didn't have the big soft plays
Agreed.
That they do now. These gigantic three-story tall wonderlands
so envious.
Of things to climb over and fall down and all the rest.
Was it like Funhouse had come to life, but better?
Pretty much. And the volume was such that my extremely talkative 3.5-year-old niece at one point had to take a time out and go to a different room because she said it was just too noisy because everyone was having such a blast. And of course, that's only the parents. I mean, the kids were quiet as mice. It was an insight into that tiny world of younger people. There were a lot of fruit shoots in evidence. There were a lot of refillable water bottles with cartoon characters on.
Did you have any air-ups there? Air-ups are very big with my under 8-year-old
no,
nephews.
What are air-ups?
These are, again, I feel like somebody coming from the prehistoric era discussing like new advancements in water. But seeing as children now seem completely unable to go anywhere without a water bottle, which again, I just feel like we were just all allowed to become dehydrated.
We must have been wrinkled. I don't know how we survived.
So air-ups are cartridges that you add in to a particular water bottle and they give the impression of flavouring the water without actually flavouring the water.
Oh.
So it's one of those things that tricks your nose.
You know, there were all those cold brew teas that sort of came out. I think there was a Twinings line and they were advertised as cold brew and they would give your water some nice, you know, fruity flavour without putting in loads of sugar and fruit juice and everything else. And I'll be honest, I considered them until the day that I looked at the ingredients on the back of the pack and saw they contained beetroot. And I realised, well, the impression that the tea is brewing is obviously just coming from dried bits of beetroot releasing their juice into the water. So I kind of gave up. So I wonder if it's a bit similar. Like there are things in whatever it is that give you the impression that something is happening to your water without actually imparting taste to that water.
Exactly that. The only thing that I know is that they are wildly trendy.
Oh.
I've got three nieces and nephews that live in London, cooler than I could ever have dreamt of being. That's it with the youth of
the
South
youth.
London at
well,
the moment.
I was really pleased, though, I will say. Now, the leisure centre was fantastic in terms of, you know, they had food for everybody. They had ice cream afterwards. It was one I wanted some, but apparently I was too old, which
Bruce.
Seems like age discrimination, actually. But they did still bring out jugs of squash.
Oh.
And that made me feel like maybe there's something good and true and never dying in the world, is that we still get jugs of squash frantically being refilled at birthday parties. So that was lovely.
That is really reassuring and something for me to bear in mind for my next book launch.
Just absolutely.
Just bring on the squash.
Jugs of squash everywhere. But what are we drinking today, Kat?
So, Helen, seeing as you blew my mind last week by talking about the fact that you'd just gone from zero to Martini Vibrante, which, incidentally, I notice your Italian fiancé has very kindly drunk the rest of.
He was drinking it neat. I mean, he was just knocking it back like it was squash. And I was sort of, you know, being quite restrained and having some soda water or something with it. But yeah, he just knocks it back. I don't
Absolutely
know.
Crackers. Oh, well, it's emptied the bottle. That is marvellous. So anyway, I thought enough pussyfooting around the issue. We should move on to getting you to try some of the alcohol-free wine or beers and that sort of thing. And then the PRs for Wednesday's Domain, which had popped up on my Instagram, which we mentioned last week, said, oh, can we send you a couple of bottles? And I was like, yes, that would be marvellous. So today, Helen, we're going to try alcohol-free wine. Do you want to go white first or red?
Should I ease myself in with white? Is that the less scary option?
I mean, neither of them are scary.
Well,
I think the scariest,
so.
they won't bite you, Helen. Well, actually, no, that's not true. Because in fact, the only obstacle so far has been that the bottle is beautifully wrapped in a sort of wax seal, which actually was a bit difficult to get off. But also, it has the hardest corks that I've encountered in my life.
Those were I have not encountered many corks. I do usually own a corkscrew. We should say my house has been upside down because we've been getting some work done. And the corkscrew, unfortunately, was stowed somewhere and we have no idea where. So I just ran out, got a corkscrew. And now we have Wednesday's Domain open. So here I am trying wine. So this is 0.5%, is that right?
Yes. They do two versions. This is the piquant version, which is sort of white wine. So this is a de-alcoholized. God, that's such a difficult word to say. One day I will master that. If only I were doing a podcast where I could practice. de-alcoholized white wine based drink. So the wine is Aaron Blanco. I haven't heard of that, but exciting, so we shall try. But the idea is it's Wednesday, only Wednesday, but you want to reach for a glass. Should you, shouldn't you? Pros, cons. Cue this perfect midweek tipple. Sup away with all of the pleasure, none of the regret. Just bright-eyed and bushy-tailed for Thursday. I really want to be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
That would be good,
so
yeah.
Let's have a go.
All right, here we go.
Clink.
It smells like wine.
Hmm.
Okay. It doesn't taste... Well, okay, so when I have sipped wine, it's been like someone has gone, oh, try this, it's really nice. It doesn't taste of wine at all. Or I've been at a wedding and I've, you know, touched the champagne to my lips to show willing. And there's definitely more, there's something more cutting to those wines than there is to this. Like the first impression is wine and then it almost turns into juice in your mouth. Mm. Is that right? Is that, I don't know.
That's such You're a good
wine,
way of
You've
describing
been a wine drinker,
it.
So.
Well, that's it. I think I'm in a weirder position because I'm still expecting this to be wine on some level, whereas you're coming to this with a frankly horrendous experience of basically having wine shoved in your face. And to be honest, if they were that drunk, I would very much doubt it was lovely wine. This definitely feels, this has like a stronger character to it than a lot of de-alcoholized or non-alcoholic white wines, and I do tend to sort of steer clear of them. If you were somebody who drank, this might be something more like a sort of oaky Chardonnay. There's quite a lot going on there. It's not a sort of crisp, I'm on holiday, having a posh lunch somewhere wine. But I mean, it's very convincing.
It's quite drinkable. It sort of feels like there's an outline of wine and then there's Schlur in the middle. But less sweet than Schlur.
Is this not your dream, though,
Helen? I mean, you would think, you know, it's interesting, yeah.
Now, we are using glasses that belong to your grandmother, keeper of the sherry trifle. And actually, when I smell this, I am getting like a little bit of sherry for some reason, which is slightly...
Is that the oakiness? Is that because... Is sherry oak barrels?
Possibly, but I don't know.
I'll be honest. I went on a tour of the Bush and Mills distillery because I come from there in Northern Ireland, and they used, I think, sherry barrels for some vintages. And that's why I think they're oak. I have no specialist knowledge in this area.
Actually, I think... If you were really looking for like a proper wine replacement, some of the non-alcoholic white wines can be so thin that they can just be a bit depressing, which is again why they often get mixed with loads of ice and people are like, oh, you can't tell. And it's like, kind of bit. I think if you do want to have a proper wine taste, yeah, I think that would I think that would do it for you.
And we should say it's we're drinking it cool, but not chilled or anything. Mm. So I don't know, should it be, do you think tasting it, should it be colder?
I mean, it's normally if you have a really horrible wine, then you want to serve it as cold as possible.
Right.
And there are some reds that are meant to be served cool, like some Beaujolais and that sort of thing. But I mean, this is, that's fine. This would be quite a good Sunday lunch having to drive home afterwards wine, not just a Wednesday one. So yeah, brilliant.
Okay, so that is the Wednesday's Domaine, which one?
This one is Piquant.
Piquant.
Do you want to try the, what did you say, Helen?
I was starting to say picante, and then I was like, no, that's wrong, isn't it?
Do you want to try the red one?
Let's try the red. We're on a roll now. Well, I've actually brought out four glasses just so we can do this. We can be very fancy.
I can hear the enthusiasm. So much enthusiasm. She's like, oh, the scary drink is in the glass.
You're scary. This smells much more intimidating.
This smells like a bag of sweets.
Hmm. It sort of didn't taste very much of anything as it hit my mouth. And then there's this like woodiness or something. I really don't know what words I should be using. Like I should have paid much more attention to all those wine tasters growing up. So I think
just go with your gut, Helen. It's welly boots and tires. This tastes so much better than it smells because it smells fucking dreadful. They say very clearly on the bottle, this is supposed to be like a light bodied red. And again, as I have mentioned endlessly, and you can tell I'm just hoping for like a non-alcoholic Malbec one day. That will never happen, but never mind. It is very difficult to get that oomph, that middle bit of red wine. But I must stop smelling it. Good grief. But it is woody and there is stuff there. Sorry, that sounds so vague, but it's just so many of the alcohol-free wines are just so thin that you swallow them and it's like, is there anything there? And it's like, no, it's just ghosts. This isn't as robust as the white, which is odd because whites are very rarely robust unless they are sort of 90s flashbacks. But, you know, that's okay.
Okay. I mean, it's weird to me because I'm, right, so again, not a wine drinker and I definitely Don't think I've ever had red wine except in food. So what it actually reminding me of is literally grape skins. Mm. You know, sometimes like especially when I was maybe a kid and I was just sort of playing around, I'd be sort of, you know, peeling grape skins and eating those separately. And that sort of graininess and the kind of dryness of the skin is what I'm getting. It's like we were saying the other week about, what was it that tastes like it doesn't want to be wet?
Cranberries
taste like cranberry juice tastes like it doesn't want to be wet. It feels a little bit like that. It feels like that dryness is hitting my mouth even as I'm literally sipping a liquid.
Yeah, provided that I just never use my nose whilst drinking the red version, this would be a very decent thing to have like midweek. I probably wouldn't keep it for like special occasions because it is just quite a nice sipping thing. And again, I think because I'm always expecting wine or the oomph of that, if you don't get exactly that, then that can be disappointing. But as DJ Paulette said the other week, you know, you just have to change your mind a bit about what you're expecting. You just have to find a drink that you like. And actually, this isn't full-bodied, but it is dry. Maybe this is an answer to last week's red wine question.
Oh, right.
Oh, God, it still smells so bad.
I mean, to me, it doesn't smell terrible, but I'm just smelling hint of fruit.
It's because it smells so weirdly sweet.
Okay, so is it the association of that smell with very sweet, bad wine you've had in the past, do you think?
Yeah, and also it just doesn't smell like wine. I mean, usually when you take the cork out of a bottle of wine, it doesn't take as long as it took you and I to remove the corks from these, but also you smell the cork and then you can get a sense of the wine, and you just obviously don't get that here. But you know, that's great. That's sort of leaving a bit of roughness on the top of my mouth as well,
Same.
Which is very winey.
Is this
a thing?
The
technical terms.
Okay.
It is a thing.
Ooh,
Helen.
Okay,
yes.
I'm learning.
Well done. There was a non-alcoholic wine story this week that really tickled me, which is Tesco's, who, to be honest, seem to be doing amazing PR for just promoting their own non-alcoholic stuff, had a story in the Times, which is that their number one best-selling non-alcoholic wine is Kylie Minogue's No Alcohol Sparkling Rosé.
Oh my God. Well, we're going to have to try that at some point, aren't we?
Sales of that have apparently gone up by 75% on this time last year.
Padam.
That sounds nice. I'm uncertain about non-alcoholic rosés, but I will stop being uncertain and just go, yes, let's do it.
Embrace the non-alcoholic rosé.
Yeah, so maybe we'll just have a Kylie week next week.
And I think we're also going to try making some drinks. So you were telling me about an episode of Off Menu you listened to with what sounds like an incredible drink.
Oh, it was so good. It only went up a couple of weeks ago. It's the Jamelia episode when they were on tour last year. And A, she is one of the funniest people I've ever heard not to be a professional comedian. B, she absolutely roasts the arse off each of them, which is just delightful. But also she flags one drink called carrot juice, which again becomes a bit in itself. It's not just carrot juice. But then she changed that for sexy juice,
ooh,
which is pineapple juice, condensed milk, has to be condensed milk, nutmeg and cinnamon. And
wow.
I'm thinking, yes,
I think
I would
we
like
should
that.
Probably try that. It sounds wildly unhealthy and I can't wait.
I know. I haven't made fudge for so long that I feel like drinking half a tin of condensed milk would probably make up for that.
There's some kind of maths going on there. I'm not sure it's accurate maths, but I love it.
Speaking of sugar, in fact, we should probably stop speaking about sugar. We have a sugary based guest today, haven't we?
We do. Yes, let's jump to him. So our guest today is a guy called Richard Kirk. Now, Richard got in touch with me as soon as we launched Pop Culture and basically offered his expertise. He said, I've worked in development for the soft drinks industry for about 12 years. He's now working for an ingredient supplier. And I wondered if you might be interested in talking about some of what goes on behind the scenes of the industry. I've been involved in the marketing, the development, sensory testing, manufacture quality testing, and now selling ingredients. And he's seen a number of industry shaping events, including new food labeling regulations, the sugar tax, Brexit, and so on. So we agreed with Richard that we're not going to say where he works, just because he's not here to speak for his employers, either past or present. It's not a big secret. I mean, if you want to look it up, you can totally look it up. I'm not going to, you know, say don't. But it's just not something we're getting into because he's talking from a much more general point of view as a very experienced, and this is a real phrase, beverage technologist.
What?
I know.
What a job title.
And he is also, by the way, a musician and composer, so he is a multi-talented guy. But here is what Richard had to say about sugar especially. So Richard, just to give people a bit of context about you, you are a, I believe, senior beverage technologist. You've worked in the beverage industry for quite a few years now, and you've worked on soft drinks, carbonated drinks, exotic juices I saw were mentioned on your LinkedIn, which was wonderful.
Yes.
So color, flavor, the whole thing. So you kind of have a bit of a broad overview of the industry. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I hope so. So as a product developer and now as technical services for an ingredient supplier, I have been involved in development of drinks from kind of soup to nuts. So a brief will come from somewhere, usually a marketing department, saying we want this, and then I've been involved in pulling together all of the ingredients to get a recipe that then goes to consumer testing, and then to trial manufacture, and then eventually manufacture and on the shelves, and then the always slightly confusing emotional experience of seeing litter you're responsible for on the streets of wherever you live. Because the development team will engage with everyone from marketing, sales, quality, production, I've sort of experienced a lot of the industry from various angles. That's my pitch to my credentials for being.
That's amazing. How much litter have you seen? I'm now concerned about this.
I mean, obviously, litter that you saw coming off the factory line, you feel more emotionally attached to. But it is in fact a way of finding out how successful your product has been is the litter survey. So when you're seeing it, you go, oh yeah, that's people are buying it, which is why it's a confusing emotional response, because you feel, oh, I've made some litter, but in between, someone has chosen a thing that I've worked on, exchange money to enjoy it, and then thrown it away.
Yes, it's pride, shame, all mixed up together. Very confusing. So tell me about some of the sort of the questions, I guess, that go into this. What are the challenges of launching a new drink, or I guess, you know, tweaking a formula if that happens as well? We've all heard stories about new Coke, at least. You know, what are the sort of factors that people have to worry about when they're launching a new soft drink?
For new products, who it's for. And what's the sell? Is this about tasting great? Is this about some health benefit? And what are the ingredients that are going to support that? Ultimately, then, what claims can you legally make on the pack, which is often something that can come up a bit late in the process. When the design process is working really, really well, that's sort of baked in from the very beginning, and that gives the developer the very best chance of meeting the requirements. When you're dealing with existing products, it's how much can we change, or how much money can we save, or what can we do, and nobody notice. A lot of my work has been making sure nobody notices, which is sort of less glamorous, but very necessary and happens all the time. And that could be as simple as switching out suppliers of ingredients to, as I'm sure we'll talk about, sugar reduction, which is a kind of big thing that the industry went through and is sort of still going through, but obviously. Around the introduction of the sugar tax, there was a kind of major shift in the whole industry.
So remind us when that was, because I obviously remember flawlessly exactly when that was, but some
sure.
people may
but,
not.
But for any listener who is not completely obsessed, in 2018, the UK introduced a sugar tax, which meant that any products with more than 5 grams of sugar per 100 mils would be subject to tax, and there was then a sort of mid-band somewhere around 8 bricks. Sorry, I've used the word bricks, but 8 grams per 100 mils of sugar. So above that was fully taxed. Below the 8 there was a sort of medium threshold that most people seem to have decided was a fool's errand. If you're going to reduce, you might as well reduce all the way. And then what's become a bit of a standard for a bunch of people is somewhere around 5 grams.
So you talked there about the sugar tax and levels of sugar, bricks, which is an amazing, amazing shorthand for them, which I'll be using now. But are we talking about different types of sugar here? Is that all sugars? Is that specific kinds of sugar? Is that traditional sort of white sugar? So, what does that mean?
So it's monosaccharides is the law, which means for most purposes, it means sucrose, so sugar beet or sugar cane, but also
right.
fructose, which is a without which you get to kind of molecular. It's the sugar that you find in
right.
Grapes, which is it's a bit sweeter, which can allow you to do small amounts of sugar reduction while maintaining the sweetness. So Brix, by the way, is a term that is enormously misused across the industry to mean three different things. Strictly speaking, it is a measure of the amount of dissolved solids in
okay,
a liquid.
Okay.
You can directly measure it with a machine. And so because most of the dissolved solids until, say, 2018, when the sugar tax came in, for most products the vast majority of dissolved solids was sugar, it can be used as a bit of a shorthand for the amount of sugar.
But
the third way it's used is though as a shorthand for the amount of sweetness, so the amount of sugar that you're replicating. So you can talk about aiming for 10 bricks of sweetness. That really means emulating 10 grams of sucrose per 100 mils.
Fascinating.
So I apologise if I will accidentally use each of them interchangeably, meaning a specific thing and then hoping everybody understands.
That makes sense. Okay. So, you know, we have an idea, I think in our heads, that sugar, or at least too much sugar, is bad for you. I can tell you from reading way too many diet books in my life that a lot of them will in particular pick up sugar in drinks as quote-unquote empty calories. Mm-hmm. And they really sort of rail against sugar in drinks in particular as something that people could do with cutting down on. So there must be a lot of pressure, I'm guessing, in the industry, even aside from the sugar tax, to give people options that you know, have less sugar in them. I'm guessing this has been going on for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And that dates back probably to the use of saccharin in beverages in the 50s, a long way back. I think one of the big things about sugar in drinks is it's very easy to consume enormous amounts of sugar. Very, you know, a can of Coke's worth of sugar, if you were to spoon it out onto into a bowl and try and eat that amount of sugar, you get very tired of it very quickly. But it's very easy to chug it down.
It really does. I mean, you're talking to someone who has been known to drink an entire bottle of Schlur at a dinner, you know, and that's not light in, well, there are now ones that are light in sugar, but there weren't at the time I was doing it. So what are the alternatives then? What are the things that we're talking about when we talk about sort of sugar replacements or sugar substitutes, or I don't even know what the preferred term is?
So typically you talk about high intensity sweeteners or artificial sweeteners or other things, but much of what you see now is a combination of aspartame and acesulfame K. So if you pick up most diet drinks, they will contain that combination. Maybe five or so years ago, sucralose became much more popular, partly because it sounds a bit like sucrose, and so consumers like it because it sounds acesulfame K or acesulfame potassium or aspartame always sounds horrible and chemically, whereas sucralose sounds a bit cuddlier. So it was very cheap per unit of sweetness, so it was very, very popular. It also tasted awful when first used. We as an industry have got a lot better at developing with it, and now a sucralose tasting product tastes pretty good. Aspartame acesulfame K tastes more like sugar when used right, and there are technologies that could be used to improve it on top of that. But those are the kind of the sort of mainstream ones. Less mainstream, growing in popularity, is stevia, which is an extract from a tea-like leaf, originally from Paraguay. That takes a bit of working with, because as a leaf, it tastes very sweet, but also has a really bitter lingering aftertaste. And the cheapest versions of stevia containing products suffer from that. There are quite restrictive limits within the EU and by extension the UK about how much you can use as well. So you can struggle to get the same level of sweetness that we're used to with artificial sweeteners. But it does come with a sort of much friendlier claim, like sweetened from a leaf, or which you'll see on some Marks and Spencer's products, or sweetened from a natural source, that kind of claim. So that helps people feel better about consuming it while it's still being sweet, and at least in theory delicious.
At least in theory. And that is one of the things we are talking about, obviously, on this podcast. So basically all of them have sort of strengths and limitations then. It feels like a lot of the time we're talking about a combination of sweeteners to get the same effect as sugar per se. And there's obviously trade-offs in terms of taste, in terms of cost, in terms of complicated recipes, I guess, to figure out what you're doing for each drink.
Yeah, so sugar has a bunch of things, a kind of a sweetness curve, so an experience of drinking a sugar-containing drink, which doesn't have... trouble is, everything is sort of defined in terms of the sweetness curve of sugar, so it doesn't have a really intense upfront sweetness, and it doesn't have an unpleasant linger. It's, you know, our bodies have evolved to to seek out and enjoy sugar because it's calories that the body, that's what we wanted. When it wasn't so readily available, so we kind of, somewhere between we've evolved and we've got used to that as the ideal sort of gold standard sugar curve. No sweetener has quite the same. Some, it's much more upfront. Some have a kind of a real sweet linger. Some, it's a sort of bitter aftertaste and so on. And different people perceive it differently, but that's kind of generally the case. And so combining them can allow you to cover over the weaknesses of one with the other. And then there are some flavours that can help improve that as well. There's a few different approaches kind of out there, some of which use sweet molecules at very low levels in kind of the same way that you'd use low levels of salt in baking to bring out different bits of a flavour. They do that. Others using volatile extracts from sweet things so that they smell sweeter than they are. Things like molasses or other kind of sugary products, you can extract the volatile compounds from that and add that back in. So there's a range of approaches to helping continue to trick the body into feeling like it's getting a sugar.
Wow. So just from something you're saying there, you're talking about really different levels of sweeteners depending on the drink, obviously, that you're working with. So if you're working with, I don't know, a strong flavor like ginger, maybe that allows you to do or demands that you use different sweeteners than if you're doing, I have no idea what's a weak flavor, blueberry, is it a matter of always adjusting to whatever the main flavor of the drink is going to be?
Yes, and some of that is just to do with what you know works across the range that you're working on. Some of it is to do with cost. That can be a big driver. Aspartame, one of its breakdown products, there is a people who suffer from a disease called PK can't have, and so ideally as a manufacturer you don't want your only non-full sugar drinks to contain aspartame. You want other things out there. There's a load of reasons, and some of them are about marketing, some of them are about function, some of them are about a kind of developer's preference as to how they work, and also does it have any source of sugar in there. So there are I'm going to use that word bricks again, mid-brix products where there is some sugar and then the rest is made up with sweetener. But the sugar tax has really made a thing, but was always a little bit of a driver because you could save money because sugar is very expensive and fluctuates in price in a way that can be a problem.
So would that be, sorry, is that where you get sort of no added artificial sweeteners or no added sweetener kind of claims, even where a drink clearly has, let's say, fruit juice in it, which is quite sweet on its own?
So if you're getting a kind of no added or no artificial added claims, then it's a weird little quirk of EU regulations, if I remember that rightly, that you can't talk about no artificial sweeteners. That's wrong. It's artificial colours I'm thinking of. There's no such thing as an artificial colour. There are only colours of natural colours. So fruit juices are a great source of sweetness, and they can be used alongside artificial sweeteners to make a no added sugar claim.
Okay.
As opposed to a sugar-free claim.
Yeah.
So you'll see sugar-free or you'll see no added sugar, and then somewhere on the label will be contains naturally occurring sugars. And that's very common to help along. You get a much better tasting product if you've got some fruit juice to help along, particularly if you're not adding any sugar.
I have sort of been caught out by that many times where I've got, oh, no added sugar, this sounds terribly healthy, and then I look at the empty bottles label after drinking the whole lot and suddenly realize, oh god, I've had a Mars bar and didn't really realize.
Yes, yeah, but it's fruit sugar, so it's healthier,
and there's probably some fiber in there somewhere, maybe, hopefully, as well. We're just going to go with it.
Yeah. sure. But it tastes good.
I don't know if this is too recent. I don't know if it's something you can talk about. But what about the sort of health scares that come out about some of these, you know, artificial sweeteners, you know, over time? I mean, aspartame has obviously been the one in the headlines in recent years, despite the risk being essentially, when you look into what I think it was the World Health Organization actually said, they rated it very, 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 very slightly toxic in the same way that many things in the environment are. But it was headline news around the world. Is that something that, you know, prompts panic among manufacturers and rethinks and, you know, changes to formulas?
Maybe not panic, certainly contingency plans that people will be saying, okay, well, what if this ingredient, in the same way that businesses will manage risk across the board. I think one tabloid news headline away from a particular problem at any time, and that can be, you know, and that could be sugar, or it could be artificial sweeteners, and or it could be colours, or whatever. What a tabloid newspaper chooses to go after, and whether or not there's enough, you know, they'll take people with them, it can be a worry. The fact that artificial sweeteners have given you cancer is something that everyone has known since the 1950s, despite it being not very true. I believe the source of it, and I heard this on a science podcast many moons ago, so I haven't been able to find a kind of source of this, is that there was some work done with saccharin in rats, because saccharin was being used in the 1950s in America a lot, and there were some concerns around, you know, was this well understood, and giving it to rats caused the rats to get cancer. And this was then published as a panic. Some further work was done, and it turns out that the metabolic pathways by which saccharin gave rats cancer was not something that was replicated in humans. So a lot of the time, rodents, and particularly rats, can be really good models for human beings, and we can get really important information from that. But in this case, it was a red herring. But that seems to have somehow got into the zeitgeist, and so everybody knows it, in the same way that everybody knows that E-numbers are judgmental, despite E-numbers being a list of safe ingredients that can be added to beverages and other food products safely, including vitamin C, which has an E-number, and so on. But everybody knows it. And so these are kind of, because soft drinks manufacturers, like other food manufacturers, don't get to sit everybody down and explain everything, you have to sort of, you have to go with how people feel, as I say, which is partly why sucralose has become so popular, because it's got such a lovely name.
It does, yeah.
And why front of pack claims and so on really help. Businesses will be making contingency plans. The range of sweeteners on offer allow you to have a bit of a buffer. Studies continue. EFSA is currently in a process of reviewing, as kind of on a longer scale, it is in fact in the process of reviewing everything right. All the time. That's sort of what it's there for. The European Food Standards Agency continues to express scientific opinions that are eventually turned into policy around, in particular, recommended consumption limits for everything based on people consuming enormous amounts of whatever the product is in order to keep it safe, which broadly is a good thing, but can kind of, the stuff around artificial sweeteners at the minute is a great thing if you work for a company that sells something like stevia, which is not counted, although you need to explain that it's sweetened from a natural source and not one of these artificial sweeteners, and almost always not included in the studies. So even ones that are kind of blanket, you have to explain. But EFSA is in the process of reviewing both acesulfame K and aspartame, and I believe sucralose as well. So that always makes me feel safer than it makes me feel worried, because when they really find a problem, there's been limits and restrictions long before that happens, before they find that there's a real risk, rather than waiting to find out, oh no, this is killing us all, we can stop now. So there tends to be enough time to implement changes to help keep everybody safe.
So where do you think the industry is going? I mean, you know, what are the challenges coming up? I mean, if the five bricks law went down to three or something, you know, is this something that you think is probably in contingency planning already, or is this something that would cause heart attacks across the industry?
Well, it sort of is already happening, in that there are nutritional guidelines currently in Europe, Nutri-Score, that is being adopted by a number of countries in Europe and may well be in the UK, although you never know what the UK is going to do now, because we make our own decisions now. And so I'm not entirely sure everybody knows how they make those decisions yet. So We don't know. But it's likely that we will align. VAT is a system that scores foods based on their nutritional content and is then declared on the front of pack. And everybody will want to have the best score available, and that will drive down sugar. So the 5 gram, you will see lots of products have crept below that in order to hit what was now an old version of Nutri-Score. That will probably drive things further down. The other, that hand in hand with that, is that sugar is expensive and sweeteners are cheaper. And so that will also encourage people to reduce as far as people will drive reduction for manufacturers in order to continue to take cost out. But obviously there is always a sacrifice of taste, and there is always an expectation that the product that you tasted a week ago will taste the same and will taste the same in a month's time. And that transition, doing any kind of reduction while maintaining that taste experience for the consumer, because at the point where you go, well, I don't like that anymore, you just stop buying it. You can't. It's very difficult to win you back. So in particular for larger brands, even when they're doing reduction, it will often be done in steps to kind of to take people along the ride, or with messaging to explain why or something. Big example of that becoming very controversial was in Scotland around Iron Brew. Scotland is very passionate about its Iron Brew. And so when the sugar tax came in, there was a great deal of upset, some of which has not gone away. If you look at the social media posts of Iron Brew, you'll see there are still some people who are cross about that. But lots of work was done by the company manufacturing that to make sure that it could taste as close as possible to kind of to take people with them.
Well, it's going to be a brave new world, I think. Has the profile of the people that the soft drinks manufacturers are sort of manufacturing for changed? You know, is there more talk now about sort of, you know, the kind of stuff we're covering on this program about adults growing up feeling soft drinks than maybe there would have been 10, 15 years ago, do you think?
Certainly over the last decade, the so-called adult soft drink has definitely been something that people believe there's a market for. I don't think anyone has cracked it, which I guess is part of what this podcast is about, is that they're out there. I think increasingly less sweet, less intense profile products are out there. And on the shelves in a way that kind of mainstream carbonate tends to, that you were sort of, that was what you had, and you kind of had to get on with it. Innovation has always driven the market in a way. I guess it has across all sorts of the food industry. So new things are always coming out. The ones that work, people emulate. You get innovators, fast followers, and so on, in the same across any market. So I think that that's growing, and all sorts of kind of weird extra sectors appear. The seltzer market is one that I think some people have cracked and some people haven't, going hand in hand with the hard seltzer market, which I think is in the UK, we're very much lagging behind the US, but that's something that people are trying to do, and you see those products. Seltzers don't appeal to me at all, but I like sweet and I like high impact. I have a very kind of quite childish taste in that I like. I like it sweet and I like it oomphy, in a way that a more mature consumer's bitter becomes more important, which is something basically I don't, which is why I don't like sparkling water, in honour of your podcast, I'm currently drinking a cordial made with sparkling water, and
no.
It's made with still water, I'm afraid. As I say, that I'm sure is my problem.
No, I have some of the same. I have some of the same taste buds, I think. But I appreciate you making the effort. That's very well done. I'm having a mint tea as we speak. But we do try to ask everybody when they come on this podcast, do you have a sort of Hall of Fame soft drink? What is your favorite? What is your absolute, you know, you're in a fancy restaurant, they've got everything. What are you going to order? What's your go-to?
Particularly given my experience with exotic juices, I really like juice or any mango-containing products. I really like lychee. Some people find it very floral. I really, really like it.
Yeah. I'm with you. Those are good. I see you really are into your exotic juices. You weren't kidding.
I am, yes. Not so keen on guanabana, which is a product I used to have to taste, but never really got on with. So maybe not that sophisticated, but mango and lychee, I can
definitely
get on with.
All right. Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. And best of luck with your bricks.
Thank you very much.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Helen, is it possible to be in love with somebody who works with sugar? Because I think I am with Richard.
I think that's reasonable. He's a lovely, lovely man. And thank you so much, Richard, for getting in touch. We really appreciate it. And it's also, I think, something that's really helpful to hear how these decisions get made, why they get made, and what goes into what we drink, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, so, definitely. Yeah. And if any of you have helpful jobs to this podcast, I mean, you don't even have like a crazy, sexy job title. It would be really lovely to hear from you because, again, we don't know what we don't know. And when you guys reach out to us, it is just the most brilliant and fascinating thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, popculturedrinkspodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter or we're on Instagram, Pop Culture Drinks Podcast.
That's it. So we have some people who have done just that this week.
What an excellent and obedient and just generally sexy and successful and fabulous listenership we have, Helen.
It's true. It's true. I can't deny it. So our first message comes from the incredibly well-named Cat Bird. I mean, already in love, 100%, no notes. So she got in touch from, I think, the US to say, Starbucks, it seems, is stepping into the alt-alcoholic space. What a great name for it. Yep. Below is an email ad for their new coffee mocktail. And then she quotes from them, introducing the Starbucks Reserve Orange Spice Espresso Martini. Ooh. This delicious non-alcoholic cocktail is crafted with Starbucks Reserve Espresso, spiritless Kentucky 74 spiced, vanilla bean syrup, and orange bitters, available exclusively at US Starbucks Reserve roasteries and stores. Now, I don't know if we even have those in this country, I'm afraid, but that sounds like an interesting combination of ingredients.
It really does. The US Starbucks have been really interesting in terms of their limited edition drinks. I was absolutely furious a few years ago when I was in the States and they were doing these Pokemon-based specials at certain Pokestops. This was obviously when I was still playing Pokemon Go obsessively. But the one where I was staying in Vegas had never heard of this drink. And I was like, but it's on the Pokestop. And they looked at me weirdly and I just had to leave immediately. I love the idea of having this sort of non-alc, more exciting, not more exciting, coffee is very exciting in itself, but a creation that sort of takes something else on board, because the texture of something like an espresso martini is so different to a beloved frappuccino or another sort of sugary seasonal drink. It's silkier, darker, to be more obvious about it, but it is just a sort of different feeling because of the opening hours as well. Starbucks, certainly in the UK, have become like destinations in themselves for anybody that doesn't drink or you know, doesn't want to go to an ice cream bar, as well as students or authors panicking and finishing off things that they can only do when they are bribed with coffee and cake. So yeah, having those options would be great. I mean, in the UK, it does feel like something that potentially would not take off and partly perhaps would be too much of a faff for the staff to do. But I just love the fact that that is an option.
Yeah. It's exciting. And I think it's really encouraging that, you know, again, this is entering the conversation. People are having these discussions and a big brand like Starbucks is getting behind them as well. So, yeah, I don't know if we can recreate that particular one. We might try at some point, but it sounds like an intriguing mix.
And this reminds me, actually, Ian Douglas tweeted in recently to say, had we heard of Raven Records Bar in Camden?
Yes, we still have to go there.
It's the world's first heavy metal alcohol free bar in Camden. It's found at the back of a new coffee shop and vinyl emporium, Raven Records. Just what a total dream.
Yeah.
Also, just because like there are lots and lots of musicians in recovery, and so really nice to have a place where they can go without, you know, being worried about, not necessarily being worried, but I suppose it's a bit boring to always have to think about what could have booze in it. And so nice just to have one place that is just like, no, just rock out. Don't worry about anything else.
Absolutely. And I have to say, so my Empire podcast, which is another podcast that I do, we are going on tour in March. The I'll be honest, it's not all on sale yet because we're very, very last minute about everything. But we are going to a couple of the towns that have non-alcoholic
Ooh.
Bars. So I will be doing a little call in if I can possibly manage it and trying to test out some exciting drinks.
Oh, that'd be so exciting. Take your iPhone up and hit voice note.
Exactly.
And just be like, tell me about your bar.
Please talk to
me. Yes. How exciting. Oh, I'm so pleased about that. That'll be really lovely. On last week's episode, we also very heavily hinted at us doing something so exciting that you would all hate us. And obviously the schadenfreude of that is it got cancelled. But we look forward to bringing you actual things that really make you hate us with envy in the hopefully not too distant future.
Amen to that. So this is a bit longer, but it's a very interesting topic, and I do want to speak about this. So this comes from Ben Standring, who writes, long-time listener, first-time emailer, love that, Aww. 1 month in. I love the podcast, and thank you for all the great recommendations of drinks to try. I've been sober for 5 years and stopped drinking when at university. Now, this means Ben is disgustingly young and probably handsome, but
it does
mean
that I can lower the age limit on our adverts, Helen.
Fantastic. So one thing that always makes me sigh, he says, is related to alcohol in food, notably in supermarket food and in meals out. Why do you think that supermarkets and restaurants are being more inclusive to non-drinkers by improving their alcohol-free drinks options, but a lot of their food will still contain alcohol? This is more frustrating as I fall into another category of people, the vegetarians. Mm-hmm. Side note, January is always fun when Dry January and Veganuary come around, and that's just another month. And a lot of vegetarian premium food in supermarkets is premium because it usually contains alcohol. Red wine or white wine in tomato or cream-based sauces, or brandy or port or rum in desserts. Christmas is notorious as a period when all premium products essentially just add lots of alcohol and boost the prices. Equally, going out for a meal with family or friends, most menus offer a small number of vegetarian options, and you always know there'll be a lack of variety, and many places will try and add alcohol into dishes, either to make up for the lack of meat or to add in a quote-unquote premium element to justify a higher meal price. How do you think is best to solve this? That's all the best from Ben, / someone who would like high-quality mince pies, / Christmas cake, / great vegetarian dishes without the alcohol content. And he says, cooking off the alcohol does not cook off all the alcohol. And final extra side note, just came back from my neighbour Totoro at the Barbican, and it was a delight.
Good lad. Correct.
We agree. Yes. So, I mean, this is not something I had clocked, actually, and I'm ashamed of myself for not particularly noticing. You know, as I say, I usually don't pay a lot of attention to alcohol in food just because it tends generally not to be strong enough that I notice it. I do notice it in my granny's trifle. I really did.
I really am starting to think of your granny as Nanny Og of the trifle world.
She very much wasn't. She was very much more of a Granny Weatherwax, except in regards to her trifle. But that was heavily, heavily sherried. So, you know, I would obviously eat it because I loved my granny and everything else in the trifle was delicious. Mm-hmm. But it was honestly not my favourite dessert, and I did tend to default to any of the other desserts that were around because as a family, we don't do one dessert meals. No, no. If we're getting together for a family gathering, there are at least three on the table and a gigantic bowl of whipped cream. So that was never a problem. But if you are already limited to a very small number of dishes on a menu, and then there is alcohol in them, that I can see being a real issue.
That's really annoying. It's intersections around things are where everything just sort of trips up slightly. It's, as you say, when you're vegetarian, okay, that's one thing. But then when you're vegetarian and actively looking not to have alcohol in your food, then that's another. I'm sober, but I've never got drunk off food. So I sort of have that workaround. I think it's mostly so that I can still have tiramisu, Helen, if
sure,
I'm honest.
Sure.
But at the same time, I would not order something where, I don't know, you got like a shot of amaretto and had that on ice cream.
Yes.
Yeah. One way as regards the mince pies that is super useful is particularly around anything seasonal is to literally just follow the halal food bloggers, because there is such obviously an overlap between not being able to have alcohol in food and not wanting to have alcohol in food. And so lots of the bloggers do really, really helpful roundups, particularly around Christmas food, other festive foods and everything. Because you're right, a surprising number of the supermarket mince pies contain cognac and again, it is just so that they can charge that bit extra by having that oomphy, slightly fiery taste to the mincemeat. There are always non-alcoholic ones. It's just that bit more of a faff to find them. Sainsbury's had some this year, but they weren't like classic mince pies. They were one of the, oh, we've messed with the mince pie format because it was apparently too boring.
No.
The other way of doing it is to go via the indies. There are loads of beautiful bakeries online that specifically do alcohol-free Christmas cake, mince pies, and all of the other sort of festive goodies, which are so nice. And I mean, that extends to other times of year as well. It is just that bit more of a faff than you want. Unfortunately, this is something that we see in all kinds of other areas. I mean, I'm a very, very tall woman, and so shopping is already a bit tedious. But on one of the tall forums that I'm on, you get lots of plus size people going, there is nothing for me because if I find anything tall, then it tops out at an 18 or a 20.
Yeah.
The only real answer is that unfortunately we are still in a stage where we do have to pass around this information and be like, ooh, this is amazing. This restaurant here has loads of fantastic veggie options. Plus also there's no booze on it. I mean, in London, certainly restaurants have become much better about putting menus online, largely because it's another form of advertising for them. But also, I think vegetarian food has just become so much more interesting in the last, certainly, 10 years, that if the people that you are going to restaurants with are meat eaters, then if you can persuade them at all to go to a veggie restaurant or try something else, that it's that E for experience thing, and then once they give it a go, they'll think that they invented vegetarian food and are super clever about it. But big commiserations. Yeah. It's a faff and an effort that we don't want to have.
Absolutely. I do think it's also worth writing to the offending supermarkets, etc., because I'm not saying it's going to work overnight, but the more people that feed back on this stuff, at some point it's got to reach a sort of critical mass. I think that's what's happened with, you know, vegan food. Certainly 10 years ago, vegan food was nowhere near as readily available as it is now. Gluten-free, the same thing. And so there is the potential for change. It just hasn't happened yet. I totally agree in this area. There's a way to go.
Yeah, and a tip on writing those letters as well. It's very tempting to send an email, but a letter, a handwritten letter to the CEO is much more difficult to ignore than an email from 250 people all saying the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Just thinking, when you're talking about sort of intersectional eating problems, we have a friend who is gluten intolerant and dairy intolerant and kosher, and it is extremely difficult for her to find meals anywhere, really. When she does, she embraces them close to her chest and goes regularly to that place. So I mean, there is a real business case for it. People will absolutely be loyal and afford those options. You just have to give them.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, as we see in the tall clothing community, the numbers just are not there necessarily. But then it goes around the other way as well. We've seen that Pret has had to close a load of their veggie Prets because the numbers aren't there. I mean, also just Pret seems to be going through a mad phase of pricing everything completely insanely. So interesting to see what happens there. But really wishing you some good eating.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I think that's pretty much all we have time for this week. So yes, like we say, there might be something just outrageous and infuriating happening next week. We shall see how it goes. But otherwise, that is all for this week. So if you have a favourite drink, a menu that you'd like to celebrate or shame, any burning questions or comments about soft drinks in general or particular, then you can email us at popculturedrinkspodcast@gmail.com or on Instagram at popculturedrinkspodcast. And we also have a lovely bookshop storefront where you can shop for our favourite non-alcoholic books, including those by us, which may or may not be related to alcohol, and those by our guests. So if you go to bookshop.org and search for Pop Culture, the Soft Drinks Podcast, that will pop right up.
Oh, nice, Helen.
And that is it for this episode. Do consider subscribing or leaving us a lovely 5-star review on your podcast provider of choice. I'm sure you're probably busy by now reading Kat's book, but if you're not, It's Not a Bloody Trend is now out everywhere.
There's an audiobook as well if you literally just want me in your ears more.
Which your brother bought, which is the most sweet thing I've
so
ever heard.
Lovely.
I don't think my brother bought my audiobook, so.
It was the fact he was like, I can't believe I've paid to listen to my sister talk for 8 hours. Amazing.
Amazing. In any case, we will see you back here next week for more soft drinks related chat. Thank you, Kat.
Keep drinking, Helen.
Keep drinking.
Keep drinking.
Keep drinking. Clink.
Clink.
Thank you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.